Well, clearly some of our ideas about right and wrong have changed over time. Slavery is now, as they say, a no-brainer, thankfully. But do new moral challenges loom? It certainly hasn't been a year to encourage us to feel relaxed and comfortable. Not for long. And while most of us instinctively try to do better and to do good in the world, how might we do that best, most effectively, in the 21st century? What are some of the strategies and the habits we might choose to develop? Well, to help us answer these questions today, I'm joined by three special guests. Kenan Malik is the author of The Quest for a Moral Compass, A Global History of Ethics, just a small task he took on for himself, beyond his usual broadcasting and writing. It's published by Atlantic Books. He joins us from London. Philip Pettit is a philosophy professor at the ANU in Canberra, also professor of politics and human values at Princeton University in the US. And his book, Just Freedom, A Moral Compass for a Complex World, has also coincidentally just been realised, suggesting that there is something in the zeitgeist. And Natasha Cheecher is an educator and also an ANU College of Law adjunct professor and a businesswoman. She's the director of Capacity.org. It delivers leadership training to people around the globe. Last year, she was recognised as one of Australia's 100 Women of Influence, that Financial Review and Westpac venture. And she joins us from Hobart. So, good morning and welcome to you all.
Hello.
You.
Good morning.
To you first, Kenan, what does history teach us about morality?
That's an interesting question, because I recently gave a seminar at Toronto to the university to a group of academic philosophers there who bridled at the idea that history could throw any light on morality. I think there's a tendency expressed possibly by those Toronto philosophers to view morality as occupying a sphere of its own, to imagine that it can be understood in its own terms. And that's really what I'd like to question. I mean, it's striking, for instance, that there are hundreds of books on histories of ideas and there are dozens on histories of philosophy, but very few histories of moral thought. And I think it's important to bring morality down to earth, if you like, to tell the story of morality in the same way as you can tell other historical stories to relate it to other histories, economic or social or political or intellectual. Because in my mind, concepts of morality are intimately linked to perceptions of what it means to be human. And as those perceptions have changed, as societies have developed, so thinking about humanness has changed and moral ideas have evolved too.
Yes, I mean, in a marvellous review of your book, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the UK, said he felt morality itself had become the great unspeakable. To offer a moral judgment is to be accused of judgmentalism, you know, not quite paedophilia, but not necessarily that far off. And do you think that's so?
Well, I think morality occupies an ambiguous role in contemporary society. And it occupies an ambiguous role because it occupies an ambiguous role in modernity itself. I think one of the key turning points in thinking about morality is the distinction between the pre-modern and the modern world. I mean, I know these are movable feasts, you know, talking about the pre-modern world or the modern world. These are flexible. Mm. Nevertheless, I do think there's a key distinction or a set of key distinctions that take place in Europe between, say, the 14th, 15th and the 17th, 18th centuries, when a whole host of different changes transformed the language of morality. One of those changes, for instance, is that the idea of morality as being invested in God becomes far less plausible. Not only does religious belief erode over time, but, you know, even devout thinkers, someone like Immanuel Kant, for instance, were less likely to look to God to set moral boundaries. The second came the dissolution of traditional communities. And I think this is important in understanding the ambiguity of morality in the modern world, because in the pre-modern world, morality grew out of the structure of the community, a structure that was broadly given. Society's changed, of course. You know, the Greece in which Aristotle taught was very different from that in which Homer had written. But few people entertained the idea that it was possible to will social change, and morality was about how to define right and wrong behaviours within the given structure of society. Every individual possessed a fixed place from which derived his or her duties and rights and obligations, and moral rules both derived from and defined their role within their community, their duties towards other members. But with the coming of modernity, social structures were no longer given, but became debated politically, challenged physically. You know, liberals and socialists, or conservatives and communists, monarchists and republicans, all contested the idea of what constituted a good society. And the recognition that society could be transformed, and the emergence of social mechanisms for effecting such transformation, transformed the meaning of morality, because as people rejected the idea of society as a given, so the notion of ought, what ought to be, how we ought to live, became a political rather than merely moral demand.
Well, can I just thank you, and I want to go to Philip, because I'd like your response to Kennan's thoughts, but I wonder if it's no accident, Philip, that the two of you have been absorbed by works probing whether there is a global moral code which needs to be re-explored and restated.
Well, let me take up the theme first that Kennan has been mentioning. I absolutely agree that you have some societies where the structures are taken as given, and then people work out a moral code, often with the help of great leaders, visionaries and so on, that fit with those structures. So they're designed to fit. So I think, and indeed he in his book underlines this, you find in, for example, Confucius's China, he's looking for a code that will help square with the structures he's living under. I think the same is going to be true in many cases of, say, the Indian developments or Middle Eastern developments, or indeed much of what has happened in medieval Europe. But I think at various times in history, you've had moments of change, and they aren't just in the modern era. So, for example, you know, classical Greece in the 4th and 5th centuries BC, classical Athens is clearly a place of great change where this enables people to think anew about what is, first of all, what is it we want in our social structures, and secondly, what is it we look for in our individual lives under those structures. Same is true, after all, in the Renaissance, you know, when Florence and northern Italy is in turmoil, torn in between different sorts of possibilities. You get amazingly sort of original, innovative, imaginative thinking about what we can do with our social structures, but equally about how we as individuals should live. Now, all of that really amplifies, as Kennan says, from the 1700s, 1800s on. And of course, we live, it's almost as if it's been accelerating. We live in a time of really highly sharpened sense of the structures around us are themselves quite changeable, so that when we think about what does morality demand of us, we think both of what does morality demand of us that we do in the way of shaping our world politically, institutionally and so on, but equally what does morality demand of us in our personal lives.
So, yes, so because it, I suppose I imagine, I might be wrong, of course, because I didn't live through it, I imagine it in that amazing time, about 500 BC, and during the Renaissance, there were all sorts of people offering ideas as to what this new code might look like coming out of all this turmoil. I don't hear anybody really doing that now. It's just turmoil.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, there are lots of people who are constantly talking about what we should be looking for example, in our states. You know, take the standard sorts of issues that arise in almost every advanced democracy today, to do with, you know, the place of welfare, for example, the so-called nanny state debate. Do we look for a state that actually provides welfare? Do we look for a state that, on the other hand, lets people, you know, fend for themselves? Now, there are great debates like that, but at a more general level, related to debates like that, there are issues about, well, what is our society about? What is the place of the state vis-a-vis the market, for example? What is the relationship between law
and
liberty? Which is the more important? Yeah, indeed, money. And, you know, in my own book, what I've been interested in is exploring a notion of freedom that was certainly central in, for example, the development of the Roman Republic, but equally in the Renaissance period, in the period of the English Revolt in the 17th century, in the period of course, the American War of Independence. There was a notion of freedom, which was a status for human beings. Of course, in the earlier traditions, it was tied to those who were basically male, propertied, and mainstream. But we have there a value which is celebrated in that tradition already 2,000 years ago, where you can see it as a value still relevant today, but in a different context, because, for example, it has to be inclusive. There's no question any longer of women not belonging to the constituency, the moral constituency.
I'm going to come back to that, but Natasha, if I can draw you in. because this is exactly, you work very much in applied values, as I understand what you're doing. Is anyone offering a moral code today that is really durable, can be articulated, and is thrilling to hear about for people?
Well, I think in the mainstream conversations that many of us access know, and I think there's a concomitant hunger amongst many, many people for an improved dialogue around that. I mean, I started my career as a corporate lawyer, and then I spent a lot of time working for politicians and parliamentarians, and neither of these groups have a particularly good rap as moral agents. But for me, the interesting thing about those roles was seeing behind the scenes and watching what good people under public stress do in terms of where they stand and fall on some big moral issues. So some of the questions I worked on were the Tampa crisis and 9/11 and so on. And then I became increasingly interested in how we encourage or educate people to have more opportunity to explore those questions about where we stand and fall. So I've done some of that work in universities, but now in the business sector I work a lot with young people before the systems have captured them, but also with CEOs who are in what I call the legacy period of their life, where many of them have become very concerned about what they're leaving behind and what they are or are not handing to future generations. So I often try to connect up those two groups of people, and what I find every time I work with them without prompting is that they begin to use moral language, and often the language of virtue, which goes back to Aristotle and a whole lot of quite old places. And so what I've found in that very applied work that I do outside the academy is that there is this hunger. And most recently I was doing work on this in the Balkans, in some collaboration with the Australian Embassy in Belgrade, doing leadership training with young people, and this same thing came up again, and went to a very interesting forum called Tesla Global Forum, which connected young people from around the world to interrogate the humanist peace building and indeed moral legacy of a scientist called Nikola Tesla. And I was really, I came away very optimistic really about the future in terms of how the structures of that conversation and practice may be built in coming decades. Whereas, to answer your question very, very shortly, no, I think you look around now and much of the landscape of our public and often our private dialogue about morality is quite asset stripped.
Yeah, Kenan, you were going to say something earlier, I think.
I was. I agree with Philip that there are important turning points throughout history, and Philip mentioned ancient Greece and the coming of philosophers such as Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, which was a huge turning point because it was the moment at which philosophy became reflective, moral philosophy became reflective. And Greece was not alone in that. There were similar changes that take place in India and in China, in Persia. But I think what makes modernity different, what makes the changes that take place from the 16th, 17th century different, is that for the first time we imagine that we can will social change. We can construct through our collective labours new kinds of societies. And so our moral vision is intimately tied with our political vision. The notion of the good is intimately tied with the kinds of societies we want to construct. And in part, that is promoted, nourished by the crumbling of what we may call the God-ordained order. There comes to be a real belief, a faith, if you like, that humans are capable of acting rationally and morally without guidance from beyond. It's the faith that drove Enlightenment humanism and the optimism of the 18th and 19th century. And the kinds of things that you were talking about, Geraldine, when you were suggesting you cannot find those kinds of moral claims or moral arguments, moral ideas today that you might have in the past, I think relates to the fact that we've become much more pessimistic of what it is to be human.
Human
capacities.
And you do suggest, Kenan, that the long shadow, I think you're suggesting anyway, the long shadow of the 20th century, Dachau, Belsen, the Balkans, and so on, Rwanda, really affect us more than we care to realise, that we've lost confidence in ourselves.
I think that's true. I think it begins before the 20th century. You can see it developing through the 19th century. But the history of the 20th century, certainly, of, you know, two world wars, the Depression, the Holocaust, the gulags, climate change, ethnic cleansing, all the things that you've talked about, help further shatter that old sense of hope and optimism about human capacities. Michael Ignatieff, the Canadian writer, the politician, he observed in one of his essays that we eat well, we drink well, we live well, but we do not have good dreams. And I think that's quite an apt description of the human condition at the present. And in a sense, what we've got is a kind of secular version of the fall. You know, in the Christian tradition, the fall comes with Adam and Eve's disobedience of God. In the secular world, the fall is, if you like, the product of the sapping of optimism, disenchantment with the possibilities of social transformation, and a growth of a much darker view of human nature. And we do have lost, I think, confidence in ourselves as moral beings and as beings capable of creating a morally enriched world.
Natasha, before I draw you in, because I can hear you... rebutting. I'm just going to let everyone know who's listening to Saturday Extra with me, Geraldine Duke, that you're listening to Kenan Malik, Philip Pettit and Natasha Cheecher, and they've all contributed in their different ways to discussions about how we're to live with an ethical sense in the future. And Natasha, I think, feels more optimistic, or you said you did. Go ahead, Natasha.
Well, I do. I think that pessimism might be a Western or maybe even an academic luxury, and I'm not meaning to be overly critical there, but I really have just come out from the coalface of, well, the Balkans, which has been through what in anyone's terms has been a fairly disastrous
horrors.
Fall in the last 20 to 30 years. And so I did come away incredibly optimistic myself, indeed infected, by the approach of these young people, these clusters of young people who were almost randomly selected.
Natasha? What was it that... Was it just their energy, which is not... That's not really something to hang on to.
It's not just the
energy,
or
did they have a moral code that you could understand?
They did, and they were also hungry for more of it, and also very dedicated to placing it in practical application in the lives that they were beginning to lead and the careers that they're building and indeed the businesses they're starting. And in fact, for many of them, because the structures of the society in which they operate are not as open as they are in other places to that kind of attitude, their response is simply DIY morality. They're building the spaces themselves. They're building it through their peer groups. They're finding mentors. They are refusing to be pessimistic because they have no alternative.
Philip, does that give you a sense of possibility? And I wonder where you'd place it in this general move, because that is most definitely an attitude of freedom, I would have thought there, freedom to devise your own. Or is there a risk there that it's very easy, if thwarted, to retreat back into yourselves and your own relationships, that you sort of, you test the waters, it's tougher than you think, and then you withdraw?
Shrink. Well, on the optimism-pessimism sort of spectrum, I'm actually more towards the optimistic end, I think. The word is energy. There's lots of moral energy, particularly in young people. Think of all the citizen movements we have, from, you know, prisoners' rights movements to consumer movements to the women's movement, which has been spectacularly successful, after all, to the environmental movement. These are often young people, but they're not only young people, who have extraordinary energy and just are looking for things to do to improve the lives of society, of others, people generally, but equally have got a vision for their own life. I think that, you know, for moral progress, if that's the word to use, or moral vision, you need both energy, but you also need direction. I'm less, I suppose, persuaded by what Natasha says about the evolving sort of values and so on. So, for example, take the Occupy movement, which is now a worldwide movement, which, you know, has been, I think, expressive of partly a frustration with how things are organized internationally and nationally, and particularly around corporations, but is floundering a little bit for the fact that there are all sorts of ideas out there, and we need to have the emergence of some sort of core set of ideas that will give direction to movements like this. I mean, You mentioned freedom. I think that freedom is absolutely a core idea. My own feeling is that if we're going to find direction in thinking about what our society should be doing for us as citizens, what each society should be doing for the world as a whole, what we as individuals should be contributing to, then it's very important in looking for a new moral compass to find values that have got deep roots in our tradition, you know, that will resonate and reverberate with people from different sides of society. That's why I think myself that I'm associated with this group called the Neo-Republican sort of group of trying to give life to a now old and very long established way of thinking about freedom, under which to be free is really to be not subject to the control of others in the exercise of your personal choices. And with society, it's to organize society to give each person that sort of space, which in turn, of course, requires that people in the society should be keeping tabs on those in power to make sure that what they're delivering is an arrangement under which everyone gets a fair go. Everyone has a sphere within which they both the resources and the protections and the security to pursue their own life. So it's got two sides to it. One is an image of what it is to lead a good life. And I think there can be personal ideals that vary, of course. The good life, though, involves you're pursuing in freedom your own ends and your own relationships. And the good society is the society that makes this possible for people. But of course, it requires people to have a political involvement in maintaining and invigilating those institutions to see that they're providing us with what we want.
Yes, see, I mean, as I hear that, and I think a lot of listeners will hear that as a noble aim, but they'll think it could very easily descend into a sort of Darwinism. And this is exactly where you get into the political debate, because they'll hear that as being code for, and I know Kennan wants to come in, but code for winding back the state. That is a gigantic, you know, that is the debate of the moment.
But I have to say, though, before letting Ken in, I'm sorry to be insistent, but it's not a code for winding back the state at all. I mean, freedom can be understood in two starkly different ways. The way I associate with the Neo-Republican movement, which is a radical movement, is freedom requires a status and a standing vis-a-vis others of a kind that, for example, an employee does not enjoy if he can be fired or she can be fired at will by an employer, as is standard, for example, in the United States, that a woman does not enjoy in a marriage if, without basically a culture supporting her, she can be abused in any way or by her husband or sidelined in any way by her husband. This is meant to be a notion of freedom as a civic status and a personal status that is highly demanding of our social structures. The other view of freedom is a view that says leave it all to the market. It's a free-for-all view of freedom. This requires law, it requires structure, it requires institutions, place for the market, of course. But essentially, people have got to be secured in the enjoyment, and they've got to ensure they secure themselves by their political action in the enjoyment of this sphere of autonomy in a society that is itself supportive of autonomy overall. That's not a wind back for the state. I argue this is very strongly supportive of a social democratic state.
Kennan.
Going back to this debate about optimism and pessimism, it's strange because I always think of myself as a great optimist. Nevertheless, you also have to look at the world as it is. And I agree with Geraldine and Philip about people's energy, their desire for change, and so on. And yet, you look at something like the Middle East and the Arab world, the hopes for what that was called the Arab Spring, where that has led us over the past 2 years, the hopes of those who wanted, desired, organised for freedom, for liberties and so on. You look at the questions of the way people in everywhere from Australia to Europe to America treat immigrants. The latest anti-immigrant campaigns in Australia and in Europe. And you don't see a world where the desire for change is actually transforming the world. What you see is a world which is becoming more narrow, more parochial, where people's sense of who they are, what they want, is becoming much more limited. So I think there is a real desire for change, for a more moral world. But I think Philip used the word direction. And I fear that politically, we do not have the direction to take us there.
Natasha, Would you say that this DIY code that you described, very interesting phrase, I mean, where are they looking? I suppose that's the obvious question. Where are they looking for guidance?
Well, partly they were asking me where to look, which is quite a big responsibility. They're looking into themselves. They're looking to their families. They're looking, a lot of them read a lot more. That's one of the things that really struck me by comparison with equivalent groups of young people, for example, in Australia and other parts of the West. For reasons I don't fully understand, a group of people who had read a lot of philosophy, a lot of history, a lot of science-related stuff, and the level at which their conversation to a pitch were more sophisticated than I would have expected from your average 23 to 25-year-old. So when I say DIY, I don't mean they're doing DIY values as such. I think they're doing DIY structuring and implementation of them and are hungry to find more feathers for that nest, if you like. But there's no doubt in the minds of many of those young people that they need a nest, and the nest is situated in a tree, and the tree is part of a forest and part of a larger ecosystem, which is indeed planet Earth. So I think I would agree with the last comment, certainly, that if you look at where we're all at globally, from the top and from the parts of the public discourse that we all notice because they're the ones that are mutually reinforcing, the situation looks quite grim. But when you go down below the canopy and drill down at a more granular level to clusters of people, you do find clusters of very good people who are working together to make a kind of moral web, if you like. And also one thing that struck me as well was their thinking and actions are very global. So they weren't talking about things like being involved in Occupy and Move On and all those more popularised movements. They weren't movement-focused. They were focused on accepting responsibility for themselves, building relationships with their peers and mentors, and making change in that kind of way. And I think, and very much also across borders, and also using what technology makes possible for them. And I mean, I learnt more from them than they learnt from me, I'm sure.
Very interesting.
Can I just say something? It's interesting that Natasha should suggest that pessimism comes from taking a kind of overall view, from being above the fray, as it were. Whereas if you're down on the ground, you have a much more optimistic view. But it seems to me, you know, if you look at the issues that I was talking about earlier, if you look at the experience of migrants, whether in Australia, in Europe or in America, if you look at the experience of people in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya at the moment, we're not talking, you know, from up there. We're talking about people's experiences right on the ground. And that's what concerns me. And it is at the level of people's experiences as they are lived at the moment that we have major problems, I think.
Can I just, I want to just slightly move to the role of the monotheistic religions in the global history of ethics, because this is clearly one of the turning points, and you raise this, Kenan, and I just feel that a lot of people derived their code from things like the Ten Commandments, from Confucian thought, from the prophet. What context do you still offer those? Are they still alive as a map, Kenan?
Well, for many people, clearly it is. I think one of the consequences of the greater pessimism that people feel, I think, about human capacities for moral change is that increasingly they look to some sphere outside humanity to establish, define moral codes. One of the reasons I think people are returning to religion and are looking to religion is because religion seems to provide for them more hard, black and white moral lines in a way they don't find outside. And so, yes, in that sense, the issue of religion does play a major role. I think the, you know, if you're talking historically, monotheism made a major change. It was a major shift in a major turning point in moral history. And you can understand that, I think, if you look at the way that, say, ancient Greeks or the ancients, ancient Chinese, ancient Indians, looked at their gods and the way that monotheists looked at their gods, because I think this is a fundamental change and it has shaped the way we think about morality. For the ancients, there were hundreds of gods and they were all constrained by, you know, the structure of reality. And those gods weren't judicious or wise as the monotheism was. They were vain, they were capricious, they were often immoral. And so for the ancient Greeks, for the ancient Chinese, for the ancient Indians, morality was about humans carving out themselves a space for dignity and for life within a kind of unpredictable world where the gods themselves could be highly unpredictable and often immoral. Whereas for what monotheism did was to create a notion of a god that was good, but also to create a notion of humans that were incapable of being good without God himself. It was a notion of humans as much weaker, much more incapable of acting on their own to create goodness and to create morality.
Now, can I go to Philip? Do you think, Philip, that the supposed death of God, you know, I appreciate that's highly debatable question, but I mean, the perception that religion just simply doesn't hold that same level of sway over Western thought as it did in earlier centuries, do you think that has played a role in this need for new codes to be sought out?
I do, but apart from the decline of religion, there's also the conflict of religion. I mean, and that in itself has, you know, worked towards the need for a code that transcends different religions. When I spoke earlier about the attractions, as I see it, of reworking an older conception of freedom, both at personal and political levels, partly I think it's important we go for a value like that because that has been supported on all sides by different religions. It's really been a product of the religious wars originally that each side, at least in the Western tradition, has come to see freedom to practice in its own domain, its own religious beliefs, as really important. It's become a sort of founding value. So in a word, it's very important to have values that will draw people in from different religions. On the other hand, I must say, it's certainly not the case that we are entirely indebted to religion or even the struggles between different religions for the sorts of values we've evolved. I mean, I would say, to return to a point I made earlier, I think probably the most significant moral movement of the last 25, 30, 50 years, and in history I think it will seem like a huge, absolutely huge rupture in the development of morality, moral thinking, and our societies, is the achievements of the women's movement. I mean, that is the one movement that has absolutely transformed the experience and the lives of women in most Western societies, for example. And of course, we all hope that it will spread. But that did not come out of religion. In fact, in many ways, it came despite religion.
Yes.
It came out of the sort of social movements that I felt Natasha was unfairly sort of denigrating. I mean, it's these movements where you get the energy, and it's out of these movements that you get direction. And the direction comes partly out of course, absorbing older traditions, finding rallying points, but equally of working out differences with other groups and finding a common ground.
Look, because we've only got, believe it or not, about 4 minutes left, 3 minutes left, and I just wanted to end on a different note about the role of China. I mean, this is what you say, Ken, and one of your theses is that as societies transform, so do moral values, that if there are big, big shifts underway, generally we can expect major shifts in morality. We may only see them in retrospect. And if I could get you relatively quickly to talk about China with its own very distinct philosophical traditions, its own language, its own geography, much more, as you say, aphoristic. We don't have the great big philosophical tracts like Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas or Kant. It's a more poetic, suggestive philosophy. I wonder how differently that will leave its shadow.
The whole terrain of morality is quite likely to change over the next 40, 50 years. The importance of China is partly political, partly moral. When we talk about Chinese philosophy and Confucianism in particular, we also remember that Confucianism isn't the only Chinese philosophy. It's the Chinese philosophy that we know in the West. But is this the one that has shaped the Chinese outlook for two millennia. And there's two points I think one can make about it. The first is it has created a moral code without the need for God. We often think of in the West, from kind of the narrow perspective of Western monotheism, that without God there can be no morality. And yet, you know, you look at China for 2,000 years, for more than 2,000 years, Confucianism has helped create a moral framework without leaning on a deity. But Confucianism is also a very conservative outlook. It's where that's why it served China and has served it so well for so long. Whether it can continue to serve China in the next two, three, four decades, when China becomes an entirely different nation politically and economically, that remains to be seen.
Now, Natasha, I'm going to give you the final word. What do you think?
Well, I think that in terms of how we're all going to move forwards together in terms of crafting a global morality together, a big concern that I have is the extent to which people in the West, not just young people, but older people and everyone in between, are almost completely ignorant of the framework that we've just been talking about. And I mean, there would be very few people, I think, on the street in which I live who know anything about Confucianism. I don't understand how we're going to have an effective culture and moral dialogue and interchange if we don't know more about each other's philosophical, religious and moral traditions. And so anything that advances that kind of understanding, including this kind of program, Geraldine, I think is to be commended.
Yes, look, I'll take that as...
China, Geraldine, sorry, before we leave it. I mean, I think China is very, very divided and dissident place. From the outside, it may seem we can talk about it as having a Confucian tradition, but I mean, Confucianism, the government is now seeking desperately to revive Confucian ideas. But the China, I mean, I go to China quite regularly, and my experience is that the people at least I talk to, of course, they're only a very small and academic sample, but they represent all sorts of different views. I mean, they absorb different traditions. They certainly would not sign up to a single Chinese sort of tradition of Confucianism.
Mm. Well, indeed, and to really have the last word, every culture does have that complexity within it. But
sure.
My point is that I believe that there is a serious lack of understanding amongst most people in the West of that level of complexity internally and the larger philosophical, religious, cultural frameworks within that sit. So I think that is the big challenge for us, is to build more of those bridges to enhance mutual understanding about the shades of grey,
And that's exactly where I'm going to draw this to a close. I'm aware that there's much, much more to be said, but I want to thank you sincerely, Natasha Chicha, Philip Pettit and Kenan Malik, for joining us today on Saturday Extra.
Thank you, Geraldine.
Thank you.
And Kenan Malik's book is The Quest for a Moral Compass, A Global History of Ethics. It's published by Atlantic Books. Philip Pettit's new book is Just Freedom, A Moral Compass for a Complex World, and that's published by W.W. Norton. And Natasha Chicha is the director of capacity.org, and she's also adjunct professor in the College of Law at the Australian National University. Well, while you're thinking big thoughts, I hope we prompted that anyway, we're going to take you to something altogether different, because coming up, walking in the wild Australian bushland, just the right sort of activity to ponder these questions of global ethics.